You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow. The New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, will filibuster reform happen? Will it make a difference? What of this fancy-schmancy debt suspension the Republicans will be passing today? We will ask those questions and more with Brian Beutler, Talking Points Memo. Also on the program today, Bibi Netanyahu wins, but by the hair on his chinny-chin-chin, as it were. Also, the Sierra Club reversing a 120-year-old policy, particularly relevant based upon news out of Nebraska that an alternate route for the Keystone XL pipeline has been found that TransCanada assures us will not be a problem. And if it is, they'll clean it up. Look into why the Dreamliner is sleeping? No? Grounded? I could have been more clever with that, I guess. All that and more. Before we get to that on today's program, just wrapped up moments ago, Hillary Clinton's testimony in front of Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I believe it is, right? On the deaths of four Americans, State Department officials in Benghazi about 4 or 5 months ago. And there was not much to report from this. The Republicans believe this is the greatest scandal that since Watergate, apparently. And I got to say, Clinton was sort of fun to watch. There's no real perfect clips to pull from this, but she got a little bit. She was fighting a little bit with Ron Johnson, who is the Tea Party guy from Wisconsin. But the highlight was when she was addressing Rand Paul, because she could barely keep a straight face. This guy is sort of the stupid was completely untethered. I'm not going to play you all of Rand Paul, but I think we could just play the first 25 seconds or so from Rand Paul's first. Now, remember, Rand Paul and the Republicans were convinced that Hillary Clinton was faking some type of illness to avoid testifying in front of them months ago. And here's Rand Paul's opening statement, just the opening part of his opening statement.
Senator Paul.
Thank you for appearing, Secretary Clinton, and I'm glad to see your health is improving.
Doesn't that that sound? Dripping with sincerity. I'm glad to hear that your health is improving. I'm glad to hear that your health is improving. He didn't do the air quotes, but I just did. All right, play it again from the beginning.
Paul. Thank you for appearing, Secretary Clinton, and I'm glad to see your health is improving. One of the things that disappointed me most about the original 9/11 was no one was fired. We spent trillions of dollars, but there were a lot of human errors. These are judgment errors, and the people who make judgment errors need to be replaced, fired, and no longer in a position of making these judgment calls.
Okay. Now, this is one of the strangest, first of all, one of the original 9/11, as if like the Benghazi strikes were the second 9/11. It happened on 9/11, so didn't the coup that got Allende out, right, of Chile. And maybe that's what he's talking about. The original 9/11 was when Allende got thrown out, and nobody got, you know, the CIA was involved in that, and nobody got... That was one of the biggest disappointments he had about the original 9/11. The deaths, the subsequent wars, the 10 years of sort of the police and counterterrorism state, and... You know, the fact that we still have this drone program, those were disappointments, too, of the original, or what I like to call the 9/11 classic.
Not the remake.
Right.
What a director's cut.
What a very, very strange guy. All right, we got to take a break. There should be big fireworks in the congressional hearings, but not really. I mean, this is... it's just a question of which one of these Republicans are going to say, like, and are you going to come clean on this whole Vince Foster stuff or what? All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Brian Boyler. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Brian Boyler, senior congressional reporter at Talking Points Memo. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks, Sam.
How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. So a couple of things happening today on the Hill. First is, or maybe not happening, in the Senate. Filibuster reform. Where are we at now? Now, the original proposal that Merkley and Udall had proposed was pretty much, I mean, give us your assessment of it, because I always perceived it as sort of maybe a half measure in terms of reforming the filibuster. And now it looks like we're down to like quarter measures. But tell us what the Merkley-Udall proposal is or was, or and if it's still in play.
Well, the Merkley-Udall proposal, I think, was pretty misunderstood. One piece of it, anyway, the talking filibuster would have actually genuinely changed Senate rules in a significant way. It really would have all but done away with the 60 votes as a matter of course for every big piece of legislation.
Why is that?
Right now, basically, a senator can say, I object, to allowing an up or down vote on this bill. That sets the threshold at 60, and it's basically at 60 until that senator's demands are met. And if it has 55 votes, it can't pass. What the talking filibuster rule did says, okay, the 60 vote requirement still stands as long as you hold the floor. But the second you walk away from the floor, the threshold goes back down to 51. And so as long as the majority was, you know, ready and willing to wait out whoever was making the objection, it really would have eliminated the 60-vote requirement after, you know, whoever it was, Tom Coburn or Rand Paul, decided they were tired of talking.
So it literally came down to, like, the physical stamina of the specific senator who's hoping to hold it up, as opposed to it. I mean, because I always perceived that it's something as, like, at least we're taking this out into the sunlight, and we can see that the process is more transparent, and it puts more pressure on this person. But it really is about the stamina.
Yeah. I mean, it would have accomplished both, but. You know, unless you had the entire Republican Party on board with filibustering whatever it was the Democrats were trying to do, it would have really, really greased things for the sort of, so let's say Democrats try to put together an immigration reform package that Republicans can't support. You imagine that they could get, you know, 40 however members of their conference to just keep talking. But for a nomination or for something that's got fairly broad bipartisan support, but a small number of Senate conservatives can't abide by it, they'd be really forced to talk and talk and talk and talk. And if they wanted to maintain that 60 vote requirement, and at some point, their members would stop backing them up. They'd say, look, there's plenty more than 60 of us willing to support this, so you better back down. Or if not. If there were 59 votes for something, then the talkers would have to keep day and night until Harry Reid gave up. And if he didn't want to give up, then we'd end up in a sort of standoff. But that was the idea.
Well, but let me ask you one more question.
The talking filibuster.
Let me ask you one more question. So when a senator in the past would simply say, like, you know, we're gonna filibuster this, I'm not gonna have to go up and talk, but you're gonna need 60 votes. To a certain extent, was that a bluff, or was it just simply because there was less personal, investment in having to do this, that less personal investment in having to do this, that the other senators would sign on? Because what I'm hearing you saying is that there was not necessarily always 40 votes, or I should say, not necessarily always not 60 votes that would affirmatively move a bill forward, even though a senator.
So the way things are right now is that if you have 70 votes in principle for a measure, but 30 members of the minority don't support something. A lot of the times what happens is, those 15 Republicans who support whatever the issue is will defer to their colleagues who they might agree with it in principle, but they'll support the filibuster for purposes of party unity and because they don't feel like they should steamroll the majority of their conference. But if there was a talking filibuster requirement, they wouldn't necessarily participate in the filibuster. They wouldn't lend their time and their voice and, all that was required of the talking filibuster to help, that conservative romp to block a bill.
Because it exposes them more. Right? I mean, it puts them more on the line.
Right. Correct.
Okay. And so now, what is the status? So we've got the so that's the Merkley proposal, and then we have another proposal which came out of the gang of group of eight or different eight, one of these club of eight, but now I guess is seven, right? Because with the new Senate, somebody left that gang of eight. But what was that gang of eight one, or the group of seven one?
There's a bunch of ideas floating around. I think the one I think you're getting at is the one that,
the Levin McCain
you still require a supermajority to pass a bill if it's being filibustered. But instead of putting the onus on the majority to round up 60 votes to pass something, the minority affirmatively has to find 41 to say we oppose this. So no more requiring Harry Reid to go and whip up the 58th, 59th, 60th vote for whatever is being blocked. But it's on Mitch McConnell now to make sure that Susan Collins and Bob Corker and all these Republicans are with him and willing to affirmatively vote against invoking cloture on a bill. I think that's still being kicked around as a possible reform. I know that Reid and McConnell are negotiating terms of some mutually acceptable rules reforms, but the Democratic leadership has made it pretty clear that in the next day or two, if they haven't gotten what they want from McConnell, they're going to invoke this nuclear option and pass a rules reform of their own, and that might be one of the items included.
Now, is this really I always understood the nuclear option to, I think it was first sort of raised under Trent Lott. And my understanding was the reason why it was a nuclear option is because it was basically saying to the parliamentarian, you got to leave the room for a couple of minutes, more or less, right? I mean, that was basically, it's like, go take a powder. We're going to do this with 50 votes. The difference with this attempt is that, and granted it's been through some sort of finagling in terms of drawing out the calendar, but we are still at the in the session where the Senate makes its new rules, which it does every time a new Senate is elected. I mean, is that a distinction without a difference, or is that a legitimate distinction?
I think it's mainly a distinction without a difference. I mean, the Merkley and Udall and the people who've been real prime movers on this issue have been pretty adamant that they want to do this on the first legislative day in order to avoid creating an entirely new precedent for making a major rules change in the middle of a session. As you said, it's the first legislative day, but we're already 2 weeks into the 113th Congress. And so for all intents and purposes, I think that they're basically equivalent. And I think, for whatever it's worth, I think future Congresses will, if they invoke this, will look back on it as a precedent changing event and feel a little bit less encumbered by past precedent to not do rules changes of their own. I think it's fair for the people who supported the judicial nuclear option in 2005 to turn the tables on Democrats and call it the same thing, because procedurally it's basically the same thing.
And so for people who want to know why Harry Reid is negotiating with McConnell, and I'm not, I'm not necessarily advocating this, but that's the theory behind it, right? Is that you want to avoid setting a precedent so that in the event that, down the road, the Republicans control the Senate and they decide, we're only going to let Republicans vote or some rule, that they can't point back to this and say, Democrats have already done it. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's basically it. You wield the nuclear option as a it's like carrot and stick, right? Come to an agreement with me in an amicable way, or have this stick of the nuclear option, and we're really gonna change the rules in a way that is advantageous to our current majority. But you hope you don't have to use it. That's the negotiating posture the leadership is taking, and right now they're reaching the point where they're actually brandishing a stick and saying we're ready to use it because we haven't gotten enough out of you. In some ways it's a very orchestrated negotiation, the way things often happen in Congress. I think we'll know in the next 24 to 36 hours how serious they are about it.
Based on your reporting, what do you think is going to happen?
I think that probably Reid and Dick Durbin and Chuck Schumer will back down and not invoke the nuclear option, and that the rules reform package that they negotiate with McConnell will be a disappointment to filibuster reformers, but that it'll pass with 70 or 80 votes.
Wow. Okay, great. That sounds really depressing.
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news. That's just a hunch, right? You never know. Currently, they're still brandishing the nuclear option threat.
Has the makeup of the Senate, the new makeup of the Senate changed anything when you have guys like Chris Murphy come in? And, you know, and I say Murphy in particular because Lieberman always struck me as the type of guy who sort of, was firmly planted right, you know, wherever the fulcrum of the Senate was is where he wanted to be, because that meant he had more visits to his office from his colleagues. Does it make a difference in terms of new crop of Democratic senators, or is Merkley's hand strengthened because of it?
I think what's strengthening Merkley's hand in general is the conferences or the caucus's overarching sense that that sort of playing by old rules with this Republican conference has had like a very deleterious effect on policy and on morale in the Democratic caucus, and that playing to win, or at least acting like you're playing to win, has achieved better results. They don't want Republicans to be able to gum up all of the works of the Senate and then blame Democrats for not being able to accomplish anything like they have. So they're more open to hardball tactics. But you still have a handful of committee chairmen, older Democrats who have been around in minorities a lot, and they're still a little bit reluctant to sort of threaten or invoke this the nuclear option, because they remember what it was like in the minority, and they don't want to find themselves there again in 2 or 4 years and be on the receiving end of whatever rules changes Mitch McConnell decides he wants
right.
to
So, I mean, it's not a concern. There's no concern that they're going to be in the minority and they're not going to be able to have access to the filibuster, because Democrats barely used it anyways. I mean, at least relative to what we're seeing by the Republicans. They're just worried that this is going to open the door and justify to Mitch McConnell et al. A greater rules changes, right? But I mean,
yeah, that's
I mean, just you from know, your perspective, though, isn't that was, I mean, just I know this is a tough assessment to make, but isn't that also just sort of ridiculous? I mean, it seems to me like the Republicans do what they do. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, you're there every day. You have a better sense of this. But it seems to me the Republicans are going to do what they do, that they're not basically not making changes like that because there's a lack of precedent, simply because there's a lack of will. Right. I mean, or am I off base with that? I mean, you know,
no, I think that's about right. I think here's what I think a way to say that is that Republicans have a real commitment to purpose, and they don't mind being accused of procedural hypocrisy if it means that they can advance an actually substantive agenda. So if they had won the Senate this time around and Romney had been elected president, I think that there is reason to believe that they would have been happy to use the nuclear option to grease Romney's agenda. And the Democrats should think of things in the same way. What do we want to get done? How do we use the rules available to us to accomplish what we're trying to set out to accomplish? And I think that was why Jeff Merkley, basically found a consensus view, setting aside issues of precedent, what do you think the rules should be? And they came to the talking filibuster as a compromise. And it turns out what's holding them up are these weird concerns about procedural hypocrisy or maybe giving Republicans running room to take bolder steps in the future. I'm basically with you. They should be asking themselves, what are our policy objectives and how can we use rules changes to effectuate those?
Let me one more point on this before we move on to this, to the debt ceiling. And here's where I get a little bit cynical. To what extent are there some members of the Democratic caucus, do you think, who are actually assessing it in the way that you just suggested? What are our policy agendas? And how does the rules help us go forward in that way? And they make the calculation that, hey, you know what? A certain amount of obstruction on some things may actually take some pressure off of me. If I've got to vote for X and I have some maybe financial backers who don't want me to vote for X, but I can go to them and I can say, look, don't worry, it's not going to pass. I need this vote from my other constituencies, but it's not going to pass or it's not going to go anywhere because of Republican obstructionism. To what extent do you think that's involved in some of the calculation of those people who are supposedly afraid of the precedent?
Oh, it's probably the driving force. I mean, if you thought that the Democratic Party its main objective was, passing the for instance, like the fiscal policies that President Obama ran on, another $800 billion in revenue, and limiting spending cuts to Medicare providers, they would invoke these rule changes right away and just pass the bill and be done with it. But there's, as you say, politics is about a lot more than just standing for certain ideals and then voting for them. These guys are cynical about this stuff, and that's why Jeff Merkley wasn't able to say, hey, we need to reform the filibuster, and they found 51 votes right away for just doing away with the 60-vote requirement altogether.
Because some senators like the fact that they can't do what they claim they want to do.
Yep, yeah.
Okay, I mean, so...
I said some of them like being the 58th vote for something that's going down to a filibuster.
Right, okay.
They voted for it, but bummer it died.
Right, okay. All right, fair enough. That's almost where we should have started this conversation on some level, because I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. But now let's talk about what's happening with the debt ceiling. The Republicans met at a former slave plantation last week and did some soul searching, I guess. Maybe they were around like one of those Ouija boards, and they came out of it, among other things, aside from learning not to to talk insensitively about rape, or at least that it would cost them votes. They also came out with this idea of suspending the debt ceiling limit and tying it into something that was completely unconstitutional. Explain this to us, because I can, for the life of me, I can barely figure out what's going on with it.
Okay, so.
All right, sorry, Brian. So give us an assessment of this, of what the Republicans did.
Right. So on the one hand, what they've decided is we can't actually hold the debt limit hostage to our spending demands. So they, like you said, they suspended the debt limit. They said, you guys can incur as much debt as is required to meet all of our obligations through May 18th. They didn't raise it by a dollar amount. They said, whatever you need to borrow for meeting our existing obligations through that date. That's a perfectly acceptable way to raise the debt ceiling. And on the other hand, they attached this rider to the same bill that says, if you don't pass a budget by the statutory deadline of April 15th, we'll start to withhold your paycheck, senators. And their argument is that it's probably constitutional because they're just delaying payment and not actually cutting pay or reducing paychecks over the course of the month or the year or whatever it is, but also that nobody in their right mind would be so politically tone deaf as to sue the House for violating the Constitution for cutting their pay. No senator would be that dumb. And I think they're probably right about that.
Right.
And,
I mean, the constitutional argument is pretty weak, it seems to me. But But I think you're right about the political.
One of those, yeah. It's just one of those things that even if it is unconstitutional, nobody's gonna fight for it on principle because it's not that important, and it's also politically a little bit knuckleheaded to be like, oh, I want my salary even though I'm a rich senator. So that's
right. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, what percentage
of the White House and the Senate have both signaled that they're okay with it?
What percentage of the Senate is millionaires anyways? I mean. Like,
I think 98 or 99. I think there's maybe one non-millionaire.
So they're, gosh, I'm not getting that check for whatever. What do they get? They make as a senator 200 grand, a little more.
I think it's a 300 now, maybe four. It's a lot of money.
You feel that even if you're a millionaire, I think. I don't know. Maybe not. But okay, so where does this well, first off, let's just talk about this. The claim is that there has been no budget passed in 4 years. But we have, based on the last debt ceiling deal, don't we have limits on discretionary spending? So, isn't that essentially a budget? Like, what you can't, if you can't, we've raised taxes, which is the revenue side of the budget. We've, basically put caps on expenditures, which is the spending side of the budget. It's not officially a budget, but that's a budget, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the one actual, legislative power that a budget resolution has is that if the House and Senate both pass one and then they reconcile the differences so they're operating off the same budget, it does what you said. It sets a spending limit, and it otherwise just sets out goals for, tax policy, et cetera. Everything else in the budget is aspirational. It's like a white paper for Congress on how, where they want to take the country. And that's, Republicans are really upset that Democrats basically allowed them to hang themselves with their controversial budget in the House without passing one of their own, which says we want to raise your taxes. And Democrats, in part because they didn't want to take that vote and also in part because they wanted to make the contrast between themselves and Republicans clear, were happy to just ignore this budget resolution requirement. And now they're saying, all right, well, we're past the first 2 years of the Budget Control Act. Those spending caps are no longer statutorily binding, so we need to pass a budget. And so they're perfectly willing to accede to this demand and just pretend that they were going to do it all along anyway. And that's basically what's happening.
And so they're going to pass a budget, which is going to be essentially a meaningless document anyways. Is that right?
Basically.
The real issue is going to be the fight on the sequester, because that's the one that actually deals with spending money.
Right. And so it looks like right now what's going to happen is the sequester is going to take effect at the end of February. And then pressure is going to build on Congress to replace those cuts with something. And Democrats are insisting that it be a mix of spending cuts and tax revenues via ending tax expenditures, and Republicans are saying just cuts. And so we're going to have, I think, a long, drawn-out standoff over that with defense contractors on the one hand and Medicare providers on the other, bearing down on members to come to some kind of agreement.
And don't you think the American public at one point is also going to have a problem because there's going to be a lot of severe cuts to discretionary spending. Won't it take maybe within a month or two, we're going to see a serious diminution of services, no?
Oh, I think that's true. But I think that basically the cuts on the domestic side of the sequester are defrayed over, such a variety of voting interests. That the two major forces that are most directly hit by this are, on the one hand, the defense industry, and on the other hand, Medicare providers. Those are the big, already organized and most directly targeted constituencies. So they're going to bring the most pressure. The rest of it is spread out over a zillion different discretionary accounts, and some of those will impose real pain, and others will be almost unnoticeable. But they'll be for such a variety of programs that there's no single trade association or whatever.
There's not going to be enough people who get E. coli or whose planes fall out of the sky or that they're going to be able to coalesce around that one sort of specific set of cuts.
Yeah, on the one hand, you're going to have a million different groups talking about the specific cut that happened to their specific program. But on the other, you're going to have the defense industry that's like, we just lost that huge chunk of our expected revenue stream.
Right.
And they're all already organized and prepared to pressure Congress and pressure Republicans to come to some sort of an agreement.
And how does the deferral of the debt ceiling, are these still, I know that the president was saying a month ago that these are not, he had successfully sort of shaved the debt ceiling off of this miasma of potential negotiations. But is it still sort of in play? I mean, if the sequester happens the first week of February and the debt ceiling is the first week of March, are these things still sort of like will they be conflated? In other words, are we still looking at another?
I don't think so. No.
No.
Okay. No. I mean, right now, in about 5 minutes, the House is about to vote to raise the debt ceiling through mid-May, and then if Democrats pass a budget, they'll raise it even further beyond that. I think Obama basically won the debt limit fight, and we'll see the sequester start to play out in a few weeks, and then there will be the continuing resolution to fund the government. A month after that, and those issues will play out completely independent of the debt limit. We'll get a legislative solution to those issues independent of the threat of default.
And do you think? Give me your sense of of the chances of a grand bargain surrounding the sequester. It seems to me that it's diminished greatly.
I think grand bargain talk is behind us. I think there is some chance that Republicans will say, okay, we'll give you another $400, $500, $600 billion in revenue if you take $600 billion in spending cuts from, entitlement beneficiaries. And Obama says yes to that, that would be a mini. You're still talking about a sequester that's only $1.2 trillion over 10 years in budget consolidation. So we're past this whole, major tax increase, huge entitlement cut, $4 trillion quote unquote grand bargain. I think Obama's more or less said to hell with that.
And just give me a sense of where you think there'll be real pain when we see the sequester. I mean, short of some defense contractors living in Virginia or Maryland or whatever, putting a hold on their third pool or something. But I mean, in terms of where were that pain in terms of the discretionary budget cuts come? Where will they show up first?
A lot of people across the country, but in the DC area are employed in middle-class jobs via these huge defense contracts. People will lose their jobs, at least temporarily, or be furloughed. You're going to see hits to government agencies. The estimates are that the sequester taking full effect, if it's allowed to linger for the full year, will shave nearly a percent off of economic growth. So that's, not maybe enough to trigger a new recession, but still a big source of shared economic pain, hundreds of thousands of people who would be employed not being employed or actually losing jobs they have.
And so basically it's either, I mean, is there any chance that they could simply say, you know what, let's just cut this sequester in half? Let's backload it.
Say again?
Is there any chance they could just say, we've got $1.2 trillion worth of budget cuts? Let's just agree to make it $600 billion and backload these for when the economy goes up. I mean, is that even a solution that they're contemplating, or is everybody just so afraid of the idea of the deficit and debt?
Everyone seems like they're ready to let the sequester hit. Nobody is talking about punting on it for a couple of months. Nobody's talking about diminishing its magnitude, and nobody's really talking about substantively how to replace it with something that's a little bit less chaotic in its construction. So I think we're headed for at least temporarily a sequester nation.
Wow. Weird. All right. Well, thanks for catching us up on this. Brian Beutler, the senior congressional reporter for Talking Points Memo. Thanks so much for taking
the
time.
Thanks, Sam.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's going to be interesting. And perhaps a little bit disturbing. I don't know if the theory here is that you play this out and it makes cutting Social Security benefits for people basically, I guess, my age, that much more palatable, because I'm not going to complain about it for 20 years if I'm not someone who follows politics on a daily basis, I guess.
You Generation Xers complain about everything.
Yeah, that's true.
Always.
Yeah, man.
How does that sound, by the way?
You sound much better. We got a new stand for Michael, and now that he doesn't have to contract his chest, he sounds better. And I think Matt also put your sound up a little higher.
It is a little bit higher.
All right.
But he was pretty high before.
Posture is upright, and my sound is higher? You always used to say it was at the highest.
All right, guys. This is nice. Let's keep the coffee clatch for the second half.
But that's what we're doing right now. We're going into this. We're segueing.
That's true. Coming up in that second half, we'll talk about why the Dreamliner is it's an important, you know, the issue of following the President Obama's speech, the issue of what government should be doing and not should be doing or should not be doing is fairly relevant. And that comes up even in the story of Boeing. Also on the bus strike here in New York City, Washington's governor, Jay Inslee, met with Attorney General Holder the other day to talk about pot. And how the federal government is going to deal with Washington State's now decriminalization. And really, it's not even decriminalization, it's legalization. I mean, it's brought into a legalized structure. Also, Keystone XL and this announcement by the Sierra Club. All that and more in the better half of the program, which will continue in just about 60 seconds from now. You can be a part of this program by calling in 646-257-3920. If you're watching or listening live, you can join us as well, 646-257-3920. I am now turning on my IM, which I neglected to do so earlier. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. It's members who provide 97% of revenue for this program. 97.8, 97.9. Not 100% sure what the actual figure is, but it's pretty close. So please, if you can afford to, and you listen to this program on a regular basis or semi-regular basis, head over to majority.fm right now. Click on the link, become a member, sign up, something like 30 cents a day, 40 cents a day. It's a great value. Keeps this show alive. You can also support this show by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Fair trade, co-op-owned company, 10% discount coupon code using the word majority. You can buy the majority.fm blend. If you have an Amazon link, if you buy your crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. You won't know a difference. We will. You can find that at majority.fm. Up at the top of the page, support the show. Just click on that. You'll see the Amazon logo. Click on that. You'll see it. Very easy to do. Give us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. We got clips there. Apparently, these YouTube video clips.
Subscribe to both YouTube channels. YouTube.com/Sam Cedar is where we update every day with multiple clips from today's show.
Okay, if
and
you say so.
YouTube.com/Majority Report Live for the live feed.
Majority Report Live. There you go. All right, folks. See you in the better half.